We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Cammeraygal people and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, you're listening to NITV Radio. On today's show, Tina, a tropical love story. It's a powerful celebration of First Nation storytelling, queer pride and enduring legacy of a global music icon. We speak with drag performer Ben Gratz, aka Miscellaneous, and A Journey Between the Fires. It's a deeply personal and compelling documentary following award-winning singer-songwriter Troy Cassadaly. That and more coming up on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972.
Must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Today in the headlines, Environment Minister Murray Watt has rejected a bid for work to be stopped on Brisbane's 2032 Olympic Stadium. Firefighters have called for an inquiry into the ongoing fire crisis in Victoria. A total of 11 explosive devices have been found on the streets in Canberra in the past 48 hours. That and more coming up in the news. Environment Minister Murray Watt has rejected a bid for work to be stopped on Brisbane's 2032 Olympic Stadium. The application was made under the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Heritage Protection Act and would have allowed the Commonwealth to declare long-term protection of a significant Aboriginal area. The federal minister has instead appointed an independent mediator to work with the Games authorities, community and Indigenous representatives. Traditional owners remain concerned about the preservation of the site, which is important to the Turrbal and Yuggera people, as Gaja Kerry Charlton told Channel 9 during a protest last month.
The trees are our tribal system, so as they start to destroy the trees, that is part of destroying our tribal systems.
The Lower Murray River is to be listed as critically endangered. The Lower Murray is home to more than 50 native fish species and many other animals, helps supply water to South Australia and holds cultural significance for local Indigenous groups. Environment Minister Murray Watt says he has accordingly accepted the recommendation of the Threatened Species Committee to put the listing in place in order to provide stronger legal protections for the system.
This listing covers the waterways, the wetlands, floodplains and vegetation of the River Murray downstream from its intersection with the Darling River in New South Wales, and the listing includes the iconic Coorong Lagoon. The listing provides important recognition that despite the efforts of governments and communities, the Lower Murray remains under great stress and that we need to do more to protect it and restore it.
Firefighters have called for an inquiry into the ongoing fire crisis in Victoria. A coalition of volunteer and career firefighters have demanded the probe after gathering on the steps of Victorian Parliament. More than 410,000 hectares have burned across the state, destroying 770 structures, including 228 homes. A similar level of damage to the Black Saturday fires of 2009 that killed 173 people. CFA Volunteers Group Incorporated President John Houston says firefighters on the front lines have long complained of a lack of safe appliances, equipment and basic resources, which makes the scale of the unfolding crisis entirely preventable. Coalition members will meet virtually this afternoon, Friday, to discuss their concerns over Labor's hate reforms. The talks will be led by Liberal Senator John O'Dunyam, a member of the parliamentary committee that held a parliamentary inquiry into the bill earlier this week. But the task of supporting the bill may ultimately fall to the Greens after Sue Lee came out in opposition and has appeared to walk away from it entirely. The opposition leader has told Channel 9 the coalition has real concerns about the legislation.
The government cannot answer the questions that are being asked. How can the parliament possibly vote for it? And how can the country, the Australian people, have confidence in it?
Cars and tents have been swept out to sea, caravan parks flooded, and hundreds of homes left without power after flash flooding hit tourist destinations near Wye, Cumberland, and Kennet Rivers in Victoria. The Great Ocean Road had been closed yesterday afternoon in both directions between Fairhaven and Skeens Creek. Residents in Lawn say it had rained heavily all morning before what they described as a tsunami of water came down the Wye River. Victoria SES spokesperson Alastair Drayton has told Radio 3AW his crews had never seen anything like it.
To use the unprecedented word that is actually unprecedented, to give an example, the previous Bureau of Meteorology record for an entire day was 123 millimetres. We've seen 178 millimetres in the last 5 to 6 hours.
A total of 11 explosive devices have been found on the streets of Canberra in the past 48 hours. ACT Police's Detective Acting Inspector Anna Ronski says the pipe bombs have been found on the footpaths in the suburbs of Belconnen, including near Lake Ginninderra.
Police have been contacted by several members of the public who have located them, and police have located further devices through searching the area.
The Australian Water Safety Council has released a new plan to drive down the number of drownings across the country. More than 33 people have drowned in Australian waters since the beginning of December, which the council blames on the declining water safety skills and population growth, particularly among people from countries with limited water safety awareness. The new strategy sets out to reduce drowning deaths by 50% by the end of the decade, by boosting swimming skills for all, localising water safety efforts, and strengthening coordination across sectors and jurisdictions. Australian Water Safety Council convener and Royal Life Saving Australia CEO, Dr. Justin Scar, says many of the most effective solutions are driven by local communities. Torres Strait Islanders have marked the 90th anniversary of a landmark workers' strike that sent shockwaves throughout Australia. The anniversary event has taken place on Thursday Island to remember the 9 months in 1936, when hundreds of men in the pearling industry who crewed the pearl luggers refused to work. Thomas Mayo from the Maritime Union of Australia says the industrial action shut down the pearling industry and led to better wages and conditions. He's told NITV the strike also resulted in the creation of the Islands Council, the first step towards greater democratic representation for the region.
And it led to some island autonomy, it led to better wages and conditions, so it's a significant moment of Australians, Torres Strait Islanders, standing up and fighting for what was right.
And now in sport, in the rugby league news, Australian Willie Peters is among the first names put forward to succeed Sean Wayne, who has stepped down as England coach 9 months before the Rugby League World Cup. Peters led Hull KR to the rare domestic treble in 2025 of Super League champions, league leaders Shield holders and Challenge Cup winners. The Rugby Football League says Wayne's successor will be a part-time appointment, opening up the opportunity for a Super League coach to take up the post alongside club duties. And now for today in the weather, Perth is sunny at 25, Darwin is seeing rain with possible storms at 27, Brisbane is possible rain at 26, and Sydney is seeing some rain at 22, Canberra is cloudy with some rain at 21, Melbourne is windy at 20, Hobart is cloudy at 14, and Adelaide is cloudy at 17. And that's the latest in news, sport and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio. Is having a documentary. It's called A Journey Between the Fires. It screens at 8:30 p.m. on NITV and SBS On Demand on the 18th of January in its premiere. But first, we have a conversation with Ben Gratz, a.k.a. Miss Elanius. Joining the program for Midsummer Festival in Nam, Melbourne, Tina, A Tropical Love Story, is more than just a tribute. It's bold, genre-blurring cabaret, and it weaves lived experience with music, storytelling, and dazzling drag. At its heart is Tina Turner. Have a listen to this conversation with Ben Gratz. Yama, you're listening to NITV Radio. Midsummer Festival in 2026 is exploring queer histories and futures. Today, we're joined by Ben Gratz, a.k.a. Miss Elanius. Thanks for jumping on and talking with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you give yourself a little bit of an intro? Who are you? Who's your mob? Where are you from?
Who am I? Who am I today? So my name is Ben Gratz, and I'm actually currently on Bundjalung country, but born and raised on Larrakia country up in Darwin. My family, my mum's side, come from Malak Malak, which is Daly River region, Murrin clan, which is Iwadja, also Kungarigan, which is around Lichfield, and also Badu Island on the Torres Straits. And my dad is of German, English, Irish descent.
Can you tell us a little bit about who you are? Who is Ben, but also who is Miss Elanius?
So my name is Ben, as I mentioned, and I am an entertainer. So I'm a trained actor. But over the years, I've also developed the skills of directing and creative directing and producing. So I work on my own shows, but I also help to produce other events, or I creatively direct other events as well. I've worked on the National Indigenous Music Awards up in Darwin, and also was the founder of Gurumalung Festival, which is up in Darwin as well. And Miss Elanius, well, she's been around for about 26 years. And she was really born out of my passion for acting and my time in Sydney, where I really explored my identity as a queer man and merged the two and created this fabulous character. So I have been doing drag for 26 years. I've got a number of different characters. I've got a character called Bougainvillea. I also have another character called Misinformation, which was also a part of NITV as well, where we did some work, TV pop box pops during the referendum. And then, of course, I have in my new show, Tina Tropical Love Story, the character of Miss Tina.
Can you tell us a little bit of what is Tina, A Tropical Love Story?
Yeah, Tina, A Tropical Love Story is a show that I created in 2014 for Darwin Festival. And it really is part drag, part storytelling, but also part cabaret. Tells the story of when I was 16 years of age and I saw Tina Turner live in concert in Darwin, at the Darwin Amphitheatre, and how that concert changed my life. So it's a 1 hour show that's full of love, joy, and celebrating the iconic Tina Turner, but also tells the story of me growing up in a small town in Darwin as a queer young man up there in Darwin, and then, yeah, celebrating, really. It's a celebration of the life of Tina Turner, including some fabulous artists as well.
This is part of the programming for Melbourne's Midsummer Festival. What would you say to audiences who are keen on seeing A Tropical Love Story? What will they expect to see?
Well, for anyone that would love to come and see Tina, A Tropical Love Story, I would say come along. It's a joyous show. I thought I was only going to do it once at Darwin Festival, and it's now been touring around Australia and coming back to Melbourne, actually, to be at the round at Nunawading and during Midsummer, and just so thrilled. And, you know, as I mentioned, we've got some incredible performers, got the incredible singer, Kian, who's a part of this edition, Thomas Bevan, who 2GC all the way from WA, we've got Sarumsa Suri, who's in it as well, and the Huxleys, and Cleopatra Price, and Dana Dizon, who's in it too. So it's a beautiful cabaret show that really celebrates the life of Tina Turner, but also you know, being mob and celebrating us as mob, and how Tina has really affected our lives and been such a champion for our community. And as I mentioned, seeing her live in concert when I was 16 up in Darwin, and I know a lot of people have stories of Tina Turner and how she's inspired their life or maybe changed their lives. So if you love Tina Turner, if you love rock and roll, if you love singing, come along and you will really enjoy this show.
I know you're incredibly involved in the drag scene and the creative industries. What is it like working with mob in these creative industries together to, you know, just create these amazing works and queen out?
Yeah, look, I love it. Like, I'm, you know, I was also one of the co-founders of Miss First Nation, which is a drag beauty pageant, which started in 2017, I think it was, and we just had one recently in Mianjin in Brisbane last year. And through that, I've been able to connect with so many First Nations drag artists from around the country and really create an incredible alumni of First Nations artists. And, you know, I've been a part of the creative industry since 1996 when I first moved to Sydney. Actually, 1995 when I first moved to Perth. And I just love it. Like, it's my passion. It really it fills my soul. And I just am so thrilled that I'm able to share the stage with so many incredible First Nations artists as a part of Tina. But really, all the work I do is about providing those platforms and showing that visibility and making sure that mob are front and center and have those main stage opportunities. And yeah, I'm just so, I love the creative industries. I love drag, and I'm really excited about this tour and bringing it back to Melbourne and celebrating with the community there. And, you know, our community's been through a lot, particularly, as I mentioned, after the referendum. And I think anything we can do to create joy and bring us together and really celebrate, and I think it's a positive thing. So, yeah, I love it. I'm very passionate about it. I'll be doing it for a long time until people say, oh, sit down, we don't want to watch you anymore.
So this show is being put on 6th of February. Can you tell us, for people who are looking forward to attend, where can they go for information, for ticketing? Where is it at?
So you can go to theround.com.au, the Round Theatre in Nunawading. You can have a look there for the tickets and all the information. But as you mentioned, it's on Friday, the 6th of February at 8 p.m. You can also find tickets through Midsummer as well. You can probably stalk me, stalk Miscellaneous or Benny Gratz on Instagram or BRG Productions. All the information will be on there as well. But yeah, have a look, come along. It's such a joyous show. And yeah, I just really want to fill the audience with mob to be there and really celebrate Tina Turner, but also who we are as a fabulous culture.
I want to thank you for jumping on and telling us all about Tina, A Tropical Love Story today.
No, thank you very much for having me.
That was Ben Gratz, a.k.a. Miss Elanius. To find out more information about programming and performances, you can go to The Round or to the Midsummer Festival 2026 website. You're listening to NITV Radio. NITV Radio, we just heard a song from Troy Cassadaly, and now you're going to hear a conversation from him. NITV Radio's Kerry Lee Barry has a conversation with Troy. He's an Australian multi-award winning country recording artist, and he has a documentary set to premiere, a film called A Journey Between the Fires. It hits screens at 8:30 p.m. on NITV and on SBS On Demand on the 18th of January. Have a listen to this conversation, him talking about A Journey Between Two Fires.
Troy Cassadaly, thank you so much for joining us on NITV Radio today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here to yarn about A Journey Between the Fires. And I'm going to start by letting mob know about the first line in the opening scene of the documentary. You say, it's been the hardest year of my life, no word of a lie, toughest year of my life.
Yeah, look, it definitely was. And I struggled with a lot of things after losing mum. When you're raised as an only child and she was a single mother, you realise what she gave you was so important when they leave. And so it took a little bit of time to process that loss too. So part of that process was going out to Halfway Creek, where her old place was, where I grew up, and was just doing a few rounds on the little push mower and just taking it all in and just feeling like I was back on country and feeling like I was able to let go of certain things. But it took a lot of time.
Did you write all of the songs at that kitchen table before recording them?
I reckon about 80-90% of the songs are written there, either at the kitchen table inside, or if the light wasn't good enough, I'd go out on the veranda and write on a little table out there. And the songs started to flow with each lap of the mower, and, you know, it was going round and round. I'd just start to process a few songs, and then I'd make my way back to the guitar and have a cup of tea in the afternoon and be sitting there looking at that beautiful lawn. And then I'd start, you know, thinking about how I felt and then start channeling that into some writing. And it was really, really important to, I think, get that decision too, sitting on the veranda saying that, oh, look, if I've written most of the songs here, maybe there's a chance I can record them here too, which I thought was a bit of a long shot, to be honest. I thought there's no way they're going to be able to use an old bush home in the middle of, you know, Halfway Creek to make a record. But I rang two friends and they went, oh, we can do that. Don't you worry. We've got all the gear we need. Technology's on our side. And one fella, Jordan Power, said, the beautiful part about this record is it will only sound like your mum's house.
And like you just said there, how you're going to record in this bush home. How did you record? What setup was there?
Look, like I had to move a lot of things around, as I mentioned in the documentary too. It was very hard for me moving all the stuff around in mum's kitchen. But they set up the kitchen as a bit of a control room with some speakers and a big computer screen. And then they ran all the wires out to the different rooms of my youth, you know. The guitar player was out near the shower. I was out in mum's art room where she used to paint. And that's where I had my little setup there. And in the living room, in my lounge room where I learned to be a musician, there was a big set of drums, a steel guitar, and a bass player. And they were all standing around in my lounge room near the record player. And it was just such an experience to see. I know the technology was pretty advanced to be able to make a record there, but it was just the fact that I was actually in my childhood home where I learned to play guitar and learned to play music with Merle Haggard on the stereo, and I was creating music again in that lounge room.
Were you overwhelmed with emotion while recording?
Look,
what was it like?
I'm not going to lie. We're a pretty sooky mob up here. When we get together with family, there's a few tears at different times. I mean, even just this weekend, we've had a funeral of a first cousin, and I've been to a wedding as well on the same weekend. That doesn't happen very often. But, yeah, it was an emotional experience sitting there in the house. When we struck the first chord, I think it was only when that little silk screen that mum used to use to make little T-shirts fell down the back off the curtain rail and right on my shoulder, as if to say, just remember where you are. And also I think mum would have been saying, why are all these people in our house? And it was just a little sign, I think, from mum to say she's there. And it made me feel really comfortable. And I told all the boys and the girls involved in the whole making of this thing, I said, just feel like yourself. Don't feel like you have to be anyone else, Kerry, you know, just relax and enjoy the experience of making some music. And that first week when we did all the band tracks was one of the best weeks of recording I think I'll ever do. I don't think I'll ever beat that.
What was the energy, the vibe like when you were recording it? You just described some of it there for us, but what was it actually like, the spirit, of the place?
It was just a little hotbed of creativity. It felt like cooking up a big feed. You know when someone's got something on like a curry? My auntie makes an amazing bully beef curry, and when you smell that coming through the house, there's just something really, really warming and familiar about it. It had this familiarity in the old house. And even through the week, when the whole band had gone and there was only all the crew there with me, I would cook up a few feeds that mum would cook as well, and it just felt amazing. There was electricity in the air, and then you'd walk out on the veranda and get ready to talk through the next song. And to me, it was a dream come true. I never thought it would be possible because I'm a little bit old school. I always thought, oh, well, I better hire a studio or maybe go to Nashville and record with some players there. But I handpicked the players to come out who I knew would get this project. And there was something in the air, Kerry. There was something in the air that I think created this record with us. It wasn't just us.
Sounds like black magic to me in our mob's way, in the best possible way. Sounds very magical. Tell me, what were those feeds that you cooked that your mum would cook? What did you feed the band?
they're all a bit scared of bully beef, right? So, and I said, let me allay your fears, and I'm going to cook up mum's baked macaroni that she made out of bully beef. And so as I started cooking it up, she always started with onion and garlic. And I think she sort of stole half of her recipe from my Maltese grandmother, right? So she's taken that, but my Maltese grandmother might have used a bit of corn meat and a bit of pork mince or something, but mum just went straight up two tins of bully beef. And as you're cooking up the onion and garlic and waiting for it to simmer down, you always throw in a little bit of Keane's curry and a little bit of mixed spice. That must have come from the Maltese side too. And as that was cooking, it sort of felt like the whole crew were all just coming to the kitchen for a look, sticky beacon, as to what was going on. And it was just the most beautiful smell, Kerry. It was like mum was there, but it helped with the whole healing process for me, cooking up a dish like that. And even some of the people that had never eaten corned meat before, they laid their ears back to it and thought it was one of the best things they'd ever tasted. And so it was lovely doing that. Cooking up different things. Everyone had a hand in helping out. Even our director, Belinda Miller, you know, cooked a meal one night. Everyone had a hand in. And so it was just wonderful experience for all of us. And everyone that came away, Kerry, they all reckon they left a little bit of themselves at the fire, which was lovely to hear.
And speaking about fire, in the documentary you talk about the fact that you do give everyone a smoke before they head into your home. Why is that important for you, Troy?
Well, you know, all the time that I was down there doing my healing, I sort of lit my fire and the smoke bellowed through the house, and it was a cleanse anyway. But we used to always smoke people, especially strangers who came to visit us and stuff like that. For an occasion like making a record, you want to make sure that everyone feels welcome. So we gave everyone a good smoking at the beginning of the whole process, and they all took a bit on. They all felt like they'd relaxed. And that smoke made its way through. Every morning, you'll see in the documentary, I go up chopping a little bit of hardwood off old stumps and things just to keep that fire going. That was my job in the morning because the coals are always ready to kick off, like when you're camping. So you throw a little bit on, it starts it up again. And it was a cleanse for everyone. And I felt really honoured to not only be able to make the record there, but also to have that crew there with me and share the experience. So I don't think I'll ever forget it, Kerry. I think it's something that it was a big part of my healing journey. And I still have good and bad days every now and then. But I think so many people got in touch after seeing it on NITV and said, oh, look, I was looking for the words to find how I missed my loved ones. And I think I found a few of them in this documentary.
And that's a beautiful thing indeed. Tell us about some of the songs featured on this album and that you recorded in your childhood home.
Yeah, look, I think the first song that I had written on my first trip down was Between the Fires. I was living between two fires, my fire at Halfway Creek and my fire at my little family up in Brisbane with my wife and kids. And so they needed to give me the space that I needed, I suppose, to heal properly with that sorry business that was on me. And so that was the first song. And I remember doing a demo when I went back up to Brisbane. And each time I'd come down, I'd open the gate and I'd swing that door open of the car and I would hear that song, Between the Fires. And I would always resonate with the lyric. And it made me feel like I was starting a project, I think. I normally don't know when a project has started. It just organically starts. But I think the first night, it was pitch black out at mum's place, hardly any light. All you see is the stars. And I remember hearing that song come out of the car thinking, yeah, I think this is a special one. End up being the title track.
What's it like to write about grief with your songs? Is it a difficult thing? Is it healing? I'm imagining it's a healing process. Does it open wounds as well?
It is really difficult to write about, but then it is easier as you get halfway through the project. And I can't really call it a project because it just felt like it was just, it was always going to be a journey. Like it says, Journey Between the Fires is what it was. And grief is a journey too. And it was hard. Writing the last song on the documentary, you'll see me sitting in the kitchen struggling to finish the song, struggling to even start it, to be honest, Kerry. Moving on was really about going through mum's things. And I think everyone, even people that have lost their wives or husbands, have related to some of the lines in that song. But it was probably the toughest one to record. It was the last one. It was in mum's kitchen. And you'll hear the struggles that I had on the veranda at times, with certain songs. Like I said, don't be surprised if there's a bit of crying, because I am a bit of a sook. And it was the way out for me. I've always found music a great way to rehabilitate yourself on your way through. Even when I was a kid, if I was lonely, I'd listen to songs and it got me through. Slim Dusty, Merle Haggard, George Jones, some of them old sad songs that we still play around the fire today when we're having a jam with family. They got me through. And I just think, I look at the other end of this whole journey between the fires now too, and I think to myself, I'm so glad I did it. I feel 100% better. And it gave me a real spring in my step to be able to walk away and go, well, that was something I needed to do. And everyone felt the same when they walked away and closed the door. A lot of them didn't want to leave straight away. They said, can we just hang for another day or so? And Belinda Miller had her little tent set up. It was like the Taj Mahal out there. And she said, it's almost a shame to take it down, because she loved being on that country and the peace that she felt out there while she directed everyone around. And I must say, having her and the crew there, I never had to do something twice, Kerry. Not often you get a director that can be that understanding as to what you're doing there. They make everything seamless. Walk them up to the old scar tree where we took the album cover photo. Everything was done in one take. And I have to say thank you to Ben and all the crew around me for being a little bit sympathetic to the fact that I'm old and grumpy making a record sometimes, and I don't want to be getting too much guidance on what to say. But they were really good to me and let me just express myself in one take. And then they would follow me around with the wheelbarrow while I got wood for the fire. And no one's ever been that relaxed around me. Normally you've got someone there bossing people around, but that never happened. And it was just it was a testament to Ben and all the camera crew with the two Micks that were there doing such an amazing job. And now being able to share it on NITV, I get a real buzz out of knowing, because my mum watched a lot of NITV too out at Halfway Creek, and she would have loved seeing something like this happen at her house.
Which brings me to my next question. What do you think your mum would think of this whole process, writing songs in the house, recording?
Oh, look, I think she'd be super proud. I think she would have been really proud. She loved country music. I mean, she was my sounding board, educator, everything, you know, with all the vinyl records that she had collected over all these years. Every fortnight on the trains, she'd get her pay. The last little bit of pay went towards a vinyl, and we'd go and pick it up at the local shop here. It might be Nash Villa or Buckley's Music in Grafton. And so I think she would have loved to have that steel guitar in the lounge room. There's something about the sound of it, Kerry, when it started to play with Ollie Thorpe playing the steel. He's a very handy guitar player too, but I think Mum would have absolutely loved the sound of that coming through those speakers in the kitchen. Yeah, I think she would have been super proud. I would hope she was proud of the way I dealt with everything as well. I didn't take the grief too well, unfortunately, and I think a lot of us don't. It's a slow process for Goori people where I grew up, always has been, but I do believe that it helped me immensely to make music out of that grief, and Mum would have been proud of that too. I hope she would have thought it's a great way to recover. And we've always lent on music, and I would hope she would have been really proud of that.
And what was it like growing up in this beautiful home with your mum at Halfway Creek? What was it like for you and your mum?
Look, growing up there was incredible for me. I moved out there just after I was 10 years old. We'd lost my nan, and I spent the first 10 years of my life with my nan and pop while mum worked on the trains, because she really wanted to try and get us somewhere to live that was permanent, you know. So mum said, I hope you don't mind, but I want to keep working, you know, I want to get on the trains. And I said, yeah, I don't mind, I got Nan and Pop. But when we lost Nan and Pop, everything changed. But as it turned out, mum's first cousin, Tony Barrett, was selling a place that he was looking to get rid of. And my Nan, bless her, before she died, she talked mum into buying Halfway Creek. And it was an incredible childhood. There was lots of amazing swims down the creek. There was lots of work, though, Kerry. I learned to work when I was very, very young with an axe and a mattock and a shovel. We didn't have tractors and things pulling stumps out. We dug them out by hand. So there was a lot of me left at that property when I look around that beautiful big clearing now when I mow it. I remember every stump, bub, that we got out there. And it taught me that nothing comes for free. And our grandparents had beautiful work ethic too. And I think that just drifted into our lives, and it made it into my adult life too. So it was a proud place to grow up. It was on Goombanga country. And I still, the other day, I took my son up and got some witchetty grubs out of the trees that the black cockatoos hadn't stolen from us. There were three stragglers after winter. Normally you might get one or two, but we found three and we had a little taste of them on the coals as we used to as kids. And so to grow up there was a privilege, Kerry. It was an absolute privilege.
And I'm wondering, how has the farm environment changed over the years? Because as you know, we're going through climate change. Has the landscape changed around the place that you grew up? Do things look different to how they did when you were younger? Is the creek different?
Yeah, the creek's different. It's not the same. I mean, there's a lot of farming around us too, and a lot of blueberry farms and things, and it's changed the way that our creek operates, I think. But I do notice that when my Uncle Tony and his father, Fred Barrett, would have had the property, they cleared a lot of it for cattle and horses. And I see the photos of me standing there as a little jargem on the track, and all the trees are lower. But now we've left it as a bush block. It's more like a corridor for animals. And it's 103 acres, but my uncle's place is 10 acres on the side of that. But it's all grown up now. It looks like it's old growth again. And we get all sorts of animals. We get goanna, we get lots of big kangaroos coming through and laying around there. And so it is a big nature corridor. And I do believe that we get a lot of animals come there to live because it's peaceful and there's no activity farming-wise, you know. So I'm very happy to have it like that. And I hear the birds sing in the morning. Sometimes I'll just record with my phone 1/2 a minute of all their calls. And they're always different. There's a whip bird. There's all these beautiful fryer birds, black cockatoos, all rejoicing in the fact they've got somewhere to live that's not really interrupted too much by what man can do. We've left it as it is. The only thing that really looks man-made is that big clearing around you in case there's a fire. But that lawn is worth mowing when you stand there and you have a cold drink of water and you have a look at the lawn. We've always had that going since I was a little kid, and it's been lovely to be able to maintain that as well. And so, yeah, look, I think it's been nice that it's a corridor for animals, and I want to keep it that way.
Sounds like a real proper sanctuary out there, Trocaster Daily, eh? Sounds lovely. What's next for Trocaster Daily coming up in 2026?
Feeling our way through some gigs, doing something every month while I do a bit more writing. I reckon there's going to be, while I spend a little bit of time back out there, I'm going to really concentrate on doing a bit of writing. And I want to write some happy songs. That's my goal. I want to cheer people up and know that Uncle's not just all sad. And there's a lot of good things to write about in life, you know. And I come to the stage of my life, excuse me, where you do still have things to say. I think our history is still fascinating to me. And as I get to 56 and turn 57 this year, I'm still very really fascinated by our history, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. So I want to try and bring people together with the stories as well. There's a lot of really good stories out there to talk about. So I think I'm going to do a bit more research, watch a few more Rachel Perkins documentaries. They always inspire me. She inspires me a lot, just like her beautiful father. And I think it's going to be nice to be able to just continue to learn. And as I learn, I'm hoping that I can put a few of those lessons in some songs.
Mr. Troy Cassadaly, our dear brother, thank you so much for joining us on NITV Radio today, eh?
Kerry Lee, lovely to talk to you, bub, and thanks for your time. And like I say, everyone at NITV, have a great new year. Looking forward to what you make.
Thanks so much, eh? We'll catch you next time. Take it easy,
thanks.
Eh?
Thanks, bub. See ya.
You too. Bye.
Ta-da.
Bye.